Hello and welcome to You Set the Tone, the podcast that takes an X-ray to the medical drama show ER. We examine the so? Fuck you,
pig.
Ed.
The female right. Pig.
Yes, exactly, yeah. Hello and welcome to You Set the Tone, the podcast that takes an X-ray to the medical drama show ER. We examine the show with surgical precision and celebrate the high pressure and beating hearts of the show. My name is Sean.
My name is Ed.
And I'm Sharon.
Today on the show, we are talking about Season 4, Episode 4, Good Touch, Bad Touch.
Episode 5, I thought it was.
Episode 5, darling.
We're talking about ER. Anyway.
He's not wrong. He's not wrong.
We've not even had a week off. Oh, we have, technically. But we will be,
How are we all this week? How are we all?
We're getting through. Yeah. We're getting through.
Surviving despite incredible odds, as they say.
Yes, that's the one.
Just a very relaxing week in the countryside. Well, a few days in the countryside, so I'm all chill and
that sounds
zen. There's this thing called forest bathing, which makes it sound like you get naked in the woods, but you don't. You can, but you shouldn't. And you just stand there and just let the forest wash over you and just listen to the sounds and feel the air on your skin and stuff. And it's really good. And it's free.
Sounds heavenly.
Sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, good talk, everyone.
Well, where should we start with this lot? Where do you want to start?
I know, okay, this is going to sound ridiculous, but I want to start with Jeannie and Al because I'm so angry.
Yeah.
Yes.
I don't think that's ridiculous at
Let's
all.
Get it
I
out
agree.
The way.
Let's do it.
Yeah. Jeannie's storyline is really, really short this week. So, I mean, we can probably merely discuss the rest of her day when we're talking about Mark. How much did your hearts break in that last scene?
Well, I think what's interesting, so the thing we see all the way through the episode is Malik is gathering money for the football and Jeannie is like, no. And he's like, oh, but you always played. It's been a few weeks. So what we're seeing is obviously Al is still out of work and they're having to be careful with money. And then at the end, they're both in a pub or a bar or whatever, and he's just gambled. And she says, you know, we're supposed to be careful, but he's won. So there's a little bit of a hide for the fact that he's won some money, isn't it? And then, as you say, Sean, you can carry on.
It's just, there's, in a way, there's like a second of almost going back to pre-everything normal, because he kind of looks at her and he says, don't spoil this for me. And I think there's a lot in that. First of all, Al, don't speak to Jeannie that way.
Absolutely.
But also, I think there's just a moment of this is the one feeling of normal I've had in however long. Now, I'm not saying it's a positive thing that he's gambling. He said he wouldn't gamble, but he's like, maybe just let me have this one. Mm. And you know that if it was just the two of them, and I'd say it was probably like, well, look, you won money. So grand, it's at least the happy version of you shouldn't have done that, but okay. But then his friend Billy walks in and he's just so aggressive from the off.
He's hideous. He's kind of really eyeballing them, and Jeannie's very much like, I'm gonna go over and just, you know, talk to him calmly. Mm. And Al said, no, don't do that. And then he just starts shouting, how did you get it, Al? How did you get it? Oh, it's just hideous.
Was it
it's
in the awful. Arm or was it in the booty?
Yeah.
Like, and that's, it's, you know, every person should always know, first of all, it doesn't matter how somebody acquires HIV. It doesn't matter. So, like, obviously he is not asking because he's genuinely concerned as to how Al acquired HIV. He wants to publicly shame him, which he succeeds in doing.
Yeah.
And even Al makes the point of he's not going to go over to Billy first because he's like, what do I say? How do I talk about the fact that he now has to take medication for the next 6 months?
Yeah.
So he's almost like, not that, oh, I'm doing Billy a favor by not going over. He's just like, what would we possibly have to speak about? Of course, Billy has no such qualms about airing anything private, and just roars across the bar. The barman is like in like a shot. He's got a baseball bat out. He's like, you take this outside. I don't care. You take this outside. And Jeannie, of course, is like, Al, can we please leave? Can we please leave? Mm. And And then Billy completely escalates everything even more.
Yeah.
He throws a bottle at him.
Yes.
And he misses, but the glass shatters. Now, you have to wonder how much forethought, like a second of forethought, Billy put into this, because if Al is injured or if Al is cut in some way,
yeah.
Now, depending obviously on how the medication levels are at that moment, but like, Billy, you're being a violent, aggressive pig.
Yeah.
And I have to say, when Al comes over and socks him, I mean, like, I was 100%. Like,
yeah.
I'll hold him down. You start hitting him.
Yeah, well, especially because he called Jeannie a bitch. You don't do that to Jeannie.
You do not. I was
ready,
to Jeannie.
And I'm a bit of a pacifist, but I was ready.
He does call him the. We were joking about this beforehand because it is a horrible word, and that's why I'm joking about it. But it's trigger warning. It's the word faggot, which I think is one of the most hateful words there
is. Hideous words.
Disgusting.
Yeah.
And when we say we were laughing about it, we weren't laughing about the word, we were laughing about different other F words.
Yeah, we were taking the sting out of it by making it ridiculous. Do you know what I mean? It's, but yeah, it's And it's a proper fight they get into because they're not just sort of posturing and punching each other. No. Al picks up a broken pool cue, like the thick end, and hits him with it. If you're going to hit someone with that end, you're hitting them to knock them down. You're hitting put them down, put them to sleep, and then gets on top of him, is really laying into him.
Really punching him, and Jeannie's crying in the background. Oh, no, you know, horrible. Stop, you know, don't know, Al, and it's just, it's just hideous. It's a real hideous moment. Yeah. But it's one of those moments where I think you can understand why, you know, Al did what he did. You know, you can see how he was pushed. So, you know.
Yeah. Like, it's just, it's sad. On top of everything else, it's sad. And it's, now obviously this is an extreme example, but it is the bigotry that is faced, you know, and what does he say straight away? HIV in Billy's mind, oh, you're gay. Or you sleep with
men. Exactly, you've slept with men. That's the first thing he's jumped to. And what we have to remember is, yes, although Al isn't gay, there were a lot of gay people who did obviously have it as well. So... this is might be something that they faced as well on a daily basis. So it just really highlights kind of that real prejudice and hatred and hideousness. Yeah. And I was there with Al. I wanted to beat this guy up. I also wanted to leave Virginia, but
it's still something that's weaponized against gay men. In recently, somebody made a joke with me about it at work, and
And you never know what somebody's reaction is going to be to that. So just don't. Like, you know, I can understand. Now, I would sometimes, I'll joke with my own friends with whom I have had the conversation. We know where everybody stands. We know how people would react to a certain. And that's kind of, you need to be in that, I think, that comfort zone before you use. Well, I mean, it is hateful language. Now, you can use hateful language when you're in a safe space. I know it's a strange sentence to say. You could use hateful language in a safe space.
It's a way of regaining power over it, though, isn't it? You know, I think that's why you kind of joke about this, you know, the darker sides to life, because in the safe spaces, because you can release stuff. You can try and take the sting and the power out. But like you say, Ed, you know, somebody's coming up to you at work and joking about it. Somebody you don't really know that well, or somebody who isn't, like, as you say, you know, in a safe space or a safe friend or something, don't do that. That is always ignorant. There is no kind, funny, bantery way of doing that. You are being ignorant and you are being a terrible human being, and you need to start again.
And, you know, I honestly think everybody should watch Angels in America or a similar HIV related drama to get how horrific it was.
Exactly. And how people were just left. Gay, we don't care about gay people, they deserve this, you know. We're gonna turn our backs, you know, that is also, so you think about coronavirus starting and the governments just being like, oh, actually forget it. And I know there are some governments that were very like that, but you know, for a long sustained years and years, you know, people were kind of left and it was stigmatized as a gay disease, as if they really just used it with their bigotry, didn't they? They just kind of used it to justify their bigotry, I guess.
I mean, look at the Reagans. They were big pals with Rock Hudson. Exactly. And Rock Hudson, you know, had fundraised for them and, you know, all this sort of stuff. And then he contracted the virus. He turned to them and asked for help and they shut the door on him. He was persona non grata. And that cost AIDS research 10, 15 years.
Yeah.
Which is a lot. If you think about where we've got in the last 10, 15 years with PrEP and things like that, that could have happened a lot sooner potentially.
That's the thing. The lives that could have been saved, the research that could have happened. Another good one is, and it's on Amazon Prime, I think, The Normal Heart. That's another really good one to watch, because that is a real, it's a real passionate call to action from Larry Kramer, who's the writer who obviously lived through it, and he wrote it at the time about his friends. And it's a real moment of anger, and this is what it really did to us and does to us. So
killed a generation of gay men, basically.
Exactly.
It was as he's a huge bigotry, and it was, well, you went out and did this, you went out and acquired it, so what do you expect us to do? Come on, like, I mean, it's anyway, ridiculous. And as you say, thank God now we're in a situation where we have effective treatments and we have effective preventative medications as well. Thank goodness. As you say, if only we had had that extra time and that however many lives could have been saved in the 80s. So in that very short scene at the end of the episode carries so much weight. It was
to this day, absolutely. Speaking of, I'm gonna discuss Mark next, just because I think there's a lot. He drives a lot of the story in this episode, and also he's still going through a lot, as we know. So we kind of, the first moment we see him, he's at home, he's watching TV, he's got his answering machine on because he's not up for talking to people, I guess. You know, somebody's calling it, wrong number, getting very angry because there's a man's voice on the answering machine. So Green picks it up and has a go at the guy. So we see he's still in this very bad kind of mood. And the next day when we see him, he's walking to work and Peter's, you know, buying caffeine because Peter's tired. And Peter says to him, how did you juggle kind of having a kid and being a doctor? And he says, oh, it was like a bad idea.
It's just like, Mark, dude, like, I love that as well. Peter, you don't drink caffeine, and you know, what a mistake that was. It's like, you've watched him drink coffee. This is Peter Benton. I mean, like, if he drinks anything stronger than water, something's wrong with him, you know?
He's asking advice. When does Peter Benton ever ask advice?
I know. He's such a different man this episode. We'll get on to Benton because I think he's actually adorable in this episode.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's how he continues, you know. He barks at Cynthia a bit later. And she even says, you know, you're in a bad mood. And he says, and that's when we find out, okay, he's got this deposition later for this case. I really hate the way he talks to Cynthia about it, though, because he says, they're just shaking me down for money. And I just thought, oh, God, they're so not. You know, that is such a horrible presumption. You're trying to minimise what they went through, and they're not shaking you down for money. They probably have been left with bills they can't afford.
Yeah.
And they're losing their, you know, they've lost their son. And I know one of the things is that the lawyer is arguing that he, you know, Kenny could have, Chris, oh gosh, I can't remember which one's which, sorry, could have been in the NBA. But I feel like that, I don't feel like came from the family. Sometimes lawyers do that. Lawyers overreach and go, oh, look, what we can go for is, you know, this crazy amount. And I found that really disrespectful, this continuing disrespect from Mark about that. And Jeannie asks him, you know, can you come and see one of my patients? So he goes into this lady who's obviously in pain. he's trying to do a check. She tells him he's good looking and then takes his hand and starts, you know, feeling herself up, which is very, very inappropriate. But instead of kind of coping with that and being very firm with her, Mark just gets mad at her, shouts, and then just leaves.
Just walks out. Yeah.
Like, that's not okay. Like, in any universe, that's not okay.
No.
And Weaver says, Jeannie says it later to Weaver, you know, I know it was inappropriate, but just because you're in a bad mood doesn't mean because somebody's being inappropriate doesn't mean they're not unwell. And just because you're in a bad mood doesn't mean you should stop with your duty of care kind of thing, which is what we're seeing him do. You know, we're seeing him be very angry and like that. And he even has a conversation with Doug in the bathroom, which, as I said, you know, they've definitely paid for this set, so they're going to use this set. So all these conversations are going to happen in that room. And Doug's asking him about Cynthia, because obviously he can see that something's going on. And Mark's very much like, no, there's nothing. And Doug's like, you know, she's very needy. He kind of really calls it out.
And he says something really just, he's like, you know, if I did need advice, I wouldn't ask you. I'm not sure exactly how he phrased it, but it's really like, get away from me, Doug.
It's hideous, isn't it? And Cynthia's kind of saying to him, well, I can give you a back rub, which is completely inappropriate, even if you start afterwards saying about, oh, was that really inappropriate? Yeah, it doesn't stop it being inappropriate. It is inappropriate. But she's obviously obsessed with him. I don't get it personally. I don't know. Do you think it's because he showed her a little bit of a kindness, and to her, he's like this big doctor who's got things figured out or something, because she's just like a little lapdog after him, a little puppy.
I think it's there's an element of gratitude because he invested in her.
Hmm.
And that's, you know, it's a powerful thing when she'd assumed she gave up on herself, didn't she? Because she cried and she went, like, you know, that never happened. She just moved here from another state. She needs that first chance to get a foot in the door. I think her back rub, it's definitely inappropriate, but I think she meant it in just in a really nice, friendly way that, you know, it was like a repayment of that gratitude, possibly. It doesn't change the fact that it's inappropriate.
She does also really want to touch
him. Still, I thought it was quite sweet in a way, if it was in any other place. Do you know what I mean? If they were at home, say, oh, do you want a back rub? Because you look really stressed. But at work, given the disparity in their sort of positions,
there's like, she's what the show has given us for a little bit is that you can see that he's the closest person to her so far. And I think in a way, not fair enough, offer a back rub. But there has been a blurring of the professional lines here. Like she said, would you mind walking me up to the track on the L? He said, I'll give you a lift home. You know, so he kind of has not stepped over the line, because there's no forbidding, you know, relationship, inter-work relationships. There's nothing wrong with that. But I think we can see that there's nothing coming from him other than potentially, I think he might look for solace in her, which is so obviously not where she is at.
Yeah.
And not how she is presenting herself in any way. Like, I think she is looking for a genuine connection and he is looking for a genuine 5 minutes.
And I did think it's interesting. She does seem to be the only person he's actually talking to properly about things. So, you know, he does tell her about the deposition. I'm not entirely sure. I know we're later, Doug checks in with him, but it's just interesting because he blows Doug off quite a bit through this episode. So I just wonder if it's one of those as well where he's kind of using her a bit to speak to about things that are going on rather than his own friends, and creating this kind of sense of intimacy that might not or should not be there, possibly. Yes. I don't know.
But at the same time, given she has just moved to the city, he might be her only friend right now, just because she's new to the city.
It does seem that way.
She's finding her feet. Do you mean it's
new everything, new job, new place to live,
exactly.
New entire set of people.
Like, somebody who's been friendly.
Yeah.
I think it's because she's so sweet and innocent that I worry, though, because he's just so dark at the moment, so angry, and it just doesn't feel like, it feels like you know, she's, it's the wrong time, you know, he's yeah. just going to split her apart or something because yeah. he's just got this anger in him and this darkness, and it's scary is how I feel.
I agree. It could, something, and you see it, it pops up in so many different shows, storylines, relationships, something that could be so casually, you know, non-committal for some person could end up having a serious, serious knock-on effect for somebody yeah. else. Yeah. And yeah, but anyway, okay, so Mark, yeah, like once he ends up, I think I was still surprised by how he came across the deposition. He's dodging people left, right, and center. He's he's avoiding his lawyer. He's yes. you know, trying to get away from, nearly getting away from Kerry. Jeannie, you know, has to go to Kerry. It's like, look, and you could tell, I'm not trying to get anyone in trouble. That's not what this is about. I need this form signed.
Yeah.
You know?
Otherwise, we can't claim the money back. You know, this is a huge thing. And obviously, we've seen Weaver all the way throughout here talking about how they've got no money and budget concerns. And she goes up and she talks to Mark. And again, he's being so defensive with her and so mean. And like, well, what's the point of the PAs, you know? And all Weaver is saying to him is he needs to just make sure he checks somebody over and puts thorough notes so that they can get the money, yeah. you know. And it's got nothing to do with Jeannie. It's got nothing to do with, this isn't a personal attack on Mark either. It's just the way it has to be done, and he hasn't done it.
Yeah
like it's just as simple as, Mark, do your job. That, at this point, I'm not asking you to give anyone a hug and a cuddle or anything. Just yeah. do your job. And this is something ER does very well, that, you know, sometimes even if storylines tend to maybe go on a little bit, it's, I think things come to a head once it affects patient care.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it is now affecting patient care.
Absolutely. And actually, I was thinking while I was watching that this week, I was thinking, I have to, you know, I have to kind of give props to the writers, because they used to have to write 22, 24 episodes a season, you know, and they would have to churn them out, which is very different to nowadays. I think we're used to kind of 8 episodes. So if this was a modern day show, you know, Mark would probably be over it by now. But actually in this, we got a real chance to have character studies and have stories breathe and take time. So I'm not so angry about Mark anymore. I think actually, there's a reason there. I mean, he does his usual thing. He disappears off. He goes to smoke by the river, and that's when, you know, Cynthia finds him and gives him the said back rub.
Yeah. Yeah.
Out in the open.
Disgusting. And then
filthy heterosexuals rubbing it in our face.
I know, it's so inappropriate, honestly. What will the children, how do I explain to children if we're walking past them about what's going on?
Is that where babies come from? Well, it's the beginning of it, yes.
I will say they were cute together at the reception desk talking about ding-dongs.
They were cute together, ding-dongs and ho-hos.
Or king-dongs or whatever they're called.
What is with the names of snacks in America? That they're very funny names, like ho-ho, ding-dong, like very strange. We have wagon wheels here, you know. Like,
yeah, it's called wagon wheels.
Jaffa cakes.
Biscuit. And also, a biscuit is something you have with, and I'm sorry to the Americans out there, I really am. Yes. But biscuit's something you have with your tea. A biscuit is not a scone.
Oh,
biscuits and gravy is a thing.
Although,
as I said that out loud, now I kind of want to try that.
Well, I could dip a rich tea in some bisto gravy.
Oh, God, yeah.
Digestive might go with it, because you can have, like, digestives with cheese, so it's like there's a savoury thing to digestives, and they are really nice with a nice
but Americans, cheese. Or when they talk about biscuits, aren't the same as our, when they discuss biscuits, like biscuits and gravy, it's different to what we
I think it's more like scones.
Biscuits. Yeah.
They're like a savoury scone or something. Aren't they look like that. Yeah.
Anyway.
I'd love a slab of beef and a nice cherry scone beside it. That sounds good to me. Yeah. Slathered in gravy. Yeah, absolutely.
He's pregnant, ladies and gentlemen. Yes.
That's it. I'm getting my cravings.
So he goes to his deposition, where he's starting out quite well. You know, he's doing what the lawyer said to him. Yes, no, can't recall. And then he just gets more, you know, as the questions go on and kind of the brother gets a bit more angry, like, you weren't really that sorry and you didn't really care about life. And he just blows up and he says, what is it you want me to say? I'm a racist. Yes, I'm racist. And just handles it in the worst way, gets really aggressive. And if I was that lawyer, I'd be like, okay, we're going to end up having to pay out much money, because he shows he has absolutely no cool, you know. Because for a while he's making sense. He's saying, you know, we make calls and we make judgments and people come in and we work on them and you know, we lose patience and it's horrible. You know, it doesn't mean we're at fault, but you know, we still find it tough. You're very measured, but then it just
he
just loses it.
There's no question in his mind, despite the alibi, despite the police completely clearing him, there's no question that he is sitting there with his attacker. Which is just like, Mark, like, it wasn't him.
Yeah, that's it. He keeps saying it, though, doesn't he? He keeps referring to it and bringing it up and saying, you attacked me. Well, you would know. And he's sitting there just like, I don't know what you're talking about. And all it does is it makes him come off as more paranoid and just maybe even more unhinged.
Completely. Yeah, and prejudiced as well, because he says things like, you of all people. And says, okay, if I'm racist, it's just like, that's been recorded for the record, Mark.
Yeah, yeah. And then, I'm sorry, I was just thinking back to the O'Brien case, because when the O'Brien case happened, and maybe it's because Mark got beaten up this time, but, you know, the O'Brien case, he was quite sorry and he felt really awful, whereas this one, he seems to have gone defensive, but I think, you know, I think the beating didn't help with that, did it?
It's whatever, and, you know, a lot of this is coming from a place of racial prejudice from Mark, and it's so sad to see it, because he's at this moment in his storyline. He's a great example for, he's a good guy. He's a little bit racist, but he's a good guy. He's a good. It's like, well, no, you don't get to be a little bit racist and then still be called a good guy. So I'm sorry to say, Mark is a bad guy at the moment.
Yes.
You know, he is not working through his prejudice, first of all. He's, as you say, Sharon, he's completely dug in with his defenses, and it has become me versus them.
Yes.
And, you know, it's like, oh my God. And we know exactly who them are in his mind.
Mm-hmm.
Then there is, you know, this poisonous way of thinking has overcome his previously displayed, we look after patients, we look after everyone. If you think back all the way to the pilot episode, when Carol is brought in, he's, you know, someone says, why do you think she did it? We don't ask that of any patient, and we're not asking that of this one. Every patient is the same. That Mark is not in this episode and hasn't been in this season of ER yet.
No.
And until he works through his issues, if I was Anspaugh and I got wind of his outburst in this deposition, I'd be like, Mark, I believe Jerry is taking some vacation days. Go and join him.
I agree, especially because Mr. McNamara later, or actually I think it happened before, but Mr. McNamara comes in. He's high. He's very violent. You know, he's attacking everybody. He's very tough. He
clocks Chuny in the face. Yeah. She bites down on the tongue. And despite Chuny and Mark's previous relationship, he's still going to be defensive to one of your own.
Yeah, and so what he does is to handle the situation, instead of trying, you know, maybe trying to get him into restraints or just trying to calm him down or held all or something, he decides to actually press on, you know, where the guy's hurt, his injury, and push on that until the guy calms down. And Anna and Doug's faces are just, they just tell you everything. They're both like, he is just gone to, this is a whole other level of behavior. And, you know, Doug says to him, like, leave, go check on Chuny. And you can see Anna's still obviously really shocked. And I think, it's just terrible. You really need, want to tag Mark out at this point and go, you need to go and look after yourself. Yeah. You should not be around patients. Yeah. Like, you've walked out of one already and now you've hurt this one, you know. Like, for whatever reason, whoever comes through that door, you have to treat them. You can't, you know, you can't do that. There are ways to manage it, anger and pain and all that stuff. And that is not it, as much as you might want to.
I mean, exactly. Yeah. In the heat, the moment, you can imagine, you know, sometimes you see movies in general. How do you win the fight? You make sure they stay down. Okay, yes. Great. So, and here is the situation. In a split second decision, I, the physician, know exactly where on your injury at a glance where I can tell you that will just debilitate you.
Yeah.
And I thought it was so interesting as well that you have Anna and Doug, who both know Mark very, very differently. There are two reactions. Yes. Anna is looking at her superior, you know, the seasoned, experienced doctor. And then Doug is looking at his friend.
Yeah.
And the pair of them are both staring on with horror. And it's just like, so if it hadn't, you know, if it hasn't come to a head yet, like we're seconds from Mark losing his license, let alone anything else.
I mean, he is very dangerous right now. And I think as well, if you, as you say, like, Anna knows him very differently, and Anna's never met old Mark. Anna met beat up Mark and never knew anything else. So she's obviously just seeing this troubled superior, you know, that everybody probably talks quite highly about. And she's like, okay, I'm not sure I'm seeing that. He seems very unhappy and now he's doing this, you know, it must be quite scary. And then, you know, but then Cynthia comes up and says to him, oh, I thought you did really well, which I was like, oh no, Cynthia, no, that's not a good, no.
No.
And then before he leaves for the evening, you know, Doug says, oh, I'm about to head out to you. I'll wait, you know, I'll just grab my stuff. And he says, I'll see you later. Like, he just completely blows him off and just wants to be alone, which, you know, is also a bit worrying kind of for Mark. Yeah. So, yeah, he doesn't have the best week.
I was just thinking, like, oh, you know, he's not accessed help for his PTSD or anything. Actually, Nina made the best offer that she could. Somebody he trusted in you and he could talk to them, or she could refer him to somebody really good, and he turned her down. So here on him, you know, it's all on him.
Yeah, he doesn't want help. Yeah. And I really thought maybe a couple of episodes ago, you know, that it would hit home and he'd be like, I need help. But he still seems to be fighting against that, and that's also seems part of his anger, really, which, you know, is tough. Should we go on to sweeter people? Should we talk about
some palate cleanser?
Yes. So Dale, no, definitely not Dale, but actually Carter does have a much better week this week overall than say last week.
That's true.
He is. The poor guy, he's been sort of lumped with another struggling med student, but this guy really wants to do well, as opposed to Chad Lowe's
Henry.
Yeah. George Henry, yeah. Henry George, whichever.
Henry George.
George Henry, Henry George. Oh, yeah.
George Henry.
Little Lowe.
Little Lowe. Well, Carter's been given himself as a med student, really, because he's everything Carter used to be. You know, he's throwing up in traumas, he's fainting at things, he's putting catheters in. You know, this is he is just Carter. So I think it's quite funny that Carter's a bit like head scratchy, because it's like, aren't you seeing mirror? But you don't always see yourself, I suppose. But that's kind of what he's got with Ivan, who he's talking to Anna about and saying, oh, I need help. You know, I'm determined to make a med student of him, is what he says. They go to do a catheter on a guy, and you know, Carter's teaching him, but Ernesto walks in and starts like having a go at Carter. So Carter gets a bit distracted, and in the time that he does that, you know, Ivan does the catheter but doesn't attach it to the to the little container, so urine ends up all over the floor, you know. Which is, I'm sorry, but if you explained that to me and said, is it Carter or Ivan, you wouldn't be able to pick, you know, if you hadn't seen the episodes for a while.
That
is straight out of the Carter playbook.
It kind of is a little bit, yeah.
It does have that brilliant line, grab that penis and show it who's boss. And I was just like, that is...
Did you also get flutters when he said that? I mean, I'm not going to lie, I felt a little
bit of a hot flush, yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
Stay away from my man.
Fair. However, he wasn't addressing your genitalia there, I'm just going to say.
Yeah.
Oh, my good Lord. I am so sorry to have assumed there for a moment. I take that back now. You sorry. Will. Yeah. Folks, if you could see the look on Ed's face right now, I tell you.
Moving on.
Before we move on, though, how do you know that's not something he says to people when he's in bed with the man he is getting them to, you know?
So you feel that he and Ivan actually had a good night together and they were just recalling a previous event?
No, I will come over there and I will kill you.
I just say, I mean, Ivan's a cute guy. I think Mark could, I think Carter could do well. He's done well
or Mark, yeah.
Or Mark or Carter, or anybody wants to have a go, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So we have that moment. And I think Carter's having a real... then Carter sees Mr. Cubits and he has to call Edson down to see his help with Mr. Cubits. When Edson gets there, it's something he's done to his foot. He says, well, you could have done this. But also, he's just so dismissive of him. He's so like, oh, it's just nice to see where you've kind of washed out of surgery and this is what you end up doing. And look at me, he's being Edson. Look at me, I'm getting to work with Rocket Romano and he's so cool and surgery's awesome. You left it all behind. And Carter's probably thinking, maybe I did, you know. I've had this breakthrough with Benton last week and now... Yeah. I'm stuck here with this med student who doesn't know what he's doing and surgery telling me how amazing they are. And he also has that moment where Dawes arguing with Ernesto, who is a gunshot wound victim, who, can I just say, so he's come back in, he's recurrent, she says to Green earlier. And she says, you know, he's got a bullseye in his back. And I thought, well, she would know. She's pretty much confessing there to what we were saying about, because I think she sees him on the street and she shoots him, and she's just like, well, bullseye on your back, you know.
One thing that I thought was just grim about this scene was, so they're going over to look at him, and when Ernesto gets up and he pulls out the IV, and then, like, it's both clever and a horrific little piece of makeup that he goes to kind of lick the wound on his arm or something, and then there's blood all over his teeth. And you know what, Ivan, I'm with you on that one. I felt it there.
Absolutely, because he just pulls it out as well, like a vein out of his IV. And Doyle basically won't let Carter kind of, because Carter's like, I could debride him, you don't have to wait for surgery. And he's like, no. She's like, no. You can't. And maybe insurance-wise, it needs to be. But I don't know.
Right, actually, yeah. It probably is an insurance thing. Yeah. Who looked after this? The intern. It doesn't matter.
The ER intern, not the surgery. Yeah, not anything surgery. That's the only thing I thought, because otherwise then Dawes just being a bit of an idiot for kind of saying no when she needs help. And then, as you say, he's aggressive and he just doesn't want to wait. So he just pulls out his IV, does that weird, horrible lick thing, and then leaves with blood on his teeth. And we'll probably see him again, I'm sure. You know, he's pissed Doyle off enough. She's going to go out that night and get him again. Horrible.
From the way that he walked away and he had the blood in his mouth and he says, see you later, chica. I wouldn't mind seeing him again down in, I don't know, the pathology room or something. You know?
In the morgue.
Yeah, it's like, I can't remember that doctor's name now, but I could just picture her.
Yes, yeah,
You know, kind of like, you know, the man had a lot of heart. Would you like to see it? You know?
She was awesome. I forgot about her. She needs her own spin-off, doesn't she?
Yes, she does.
And that's the first we hear about this Rocket Romano. You know, cool. Maybe we'll meet him later. Maybe we won't. Maybe he's a big deal. Maybe not. But we don't know.
Funnily enough, in the background, I could just hear the... Dun, dun, dun.
shivers.
And I'd kind of forgotten a little bit that it's, you know, I dance around a little bit here, but that they have this previous relationship, Rocket and Lizzie Corday, because he's the only one that calls her Lizzie. Now that I think about it,
That's right. Yeah, they really do set that up, don't they, in this episode, that actually he's the reason she's here. He's the one who sponsored her. And but back to Carter. So he's with Mr. Angevine, who's come in, and Mr. Angevine fainted while he was driving, hit some trees, he's been brought in. And inexplicably, as Carter's doing his examination, he says to Connie, we needed a CT for his abdomen, which... Connie's like, what?
Yeah, it's like, what are you talking about? Like, why are you looking at his app? And he's just like, so he was just a shade below rude.
Yeah.
I would say, like, you know, he was he skirted a line, but he's like, would you please just do it? And sometimes these things are time sensitive. And I think Connie was probably right to ask the question. I mean, yeah. She knows what she's doing.
Yeah.
What are you getting a CT scan for? And he's just like, will you please just do it? And, yeah. You know, I wonder if he was right to do that.
We do. Well, Weaver's not happy with him to start off with.
No, she Weaver is says, not.
You know, you have to, you don't do that. I know you want to reach for surgery, but that's not what we do. Please, you know, next time you have to kind of run it past me. But he is vindicated because the abdomen, there is a problem. And so, you know, just as he, but poor Mr. Angevine has kind of lost, you know, he's crashed. So Carter's having to bring him back. And just as he brings him back, Rocket Romano, the first time we see this guy, you know, wheels it in with Edson, two of probably the most vicious surgeons. And they just sweep him up. Carter isn't even looked at or talked at or thought about. They just sweep past him. I'll teach you to do it. Don't worry. You know, really showing Carter what he's lost, because Edson's going to get to do the surgery, which is, quite a big
surgery. The patient's going to die.
Pretty much he's gone, you know. And Carter just watches them wheel out. And this is where he's starting to think, was I wrong? You know, should I... Yeah. What have I given up? Which I think happens to anybody who makes a decision. You always wonder what if, don't you, on the other side? And this is the start of that moment for him.
There's also a really well-meaning twist of the knife. He goes up to the OR because he's trying to get an update. Like one's answered the phone or anything. So he goes up and they're also like, you know, oh, we miss you so much, Carter. Oh, you're so good around here. And he's just like, not helping.
Yeah. Not helping. Exactly that. Oh, we've left your talk, you know, we've left your stuff where you left it. We love you. You're the best. And then he finds the wife, you know, the wife, Edson is telling the wife, you know, Mr. Angevine survived, and the wife's very excited and saying to the kid, look, this is Dr. Edson who saved your dad, and we're all so grateful. And Carter kind of comes up and goes, hello. And she's like, oh, hello. And he's like, I'm Dr. Carter. She's like, oh, are you a surgeon? And he's like, no, I'm in the ER. And she just goes, just completely blanks him, like, well, then you're nothing. Is,
oh, and turns away. Honestly, it was so funny. I know it wasn't meant to be funny, but I thought it was meant to be funny.
I thought the whole point was that, like, also I didn't particularly understand why Carter didn't say I'm the one who diagnosed him, but hey, that's Carter style, you know, he's not gonna
there was even a way around that. Yeah, oh, I saw your husband at the ER, we were able to identify. And then he's not technically saying I saved his life, but he's also saying teamwork.
Yeah.
You know, whereas Dale is just like, I saved your husband's life and I've also redone his taxes. So you've just saved 20 grand a year. Yeah. And also I fathered your second child for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm coming around for Christmas. Like, that's literally.
I would gift you my presents for Christmas.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But Mr. A survives, which is brilliant. But again, you know, Carter's feeling a bit rubbish, you know, thinking, oh, you know, I'm not getting that. I haven't had the win in the same way, or I haven't saved him the same way. And then there's a really sweet moment with Benton and Carter where Benton's walking home and Carter says, and they kind of see each other and they talk, and Carter says to him about Edson, and Benton's like, he's a weasel. And Carter looks a bit shocked, like, what? And he says, Carter, you're twice the surgeon Edson was. And I love that.
I know.
Who is this man in this episode? Because he's so lovely.
I would tattoo that on my head if I was Carter. The surgeon Edson is Dr. Benton.
I think he said, Dale will ever be, which is even better because, like, oh, God, Dale might have the attitude and might walk around swinging his, stuff around. But, yeah.
Well, we've seen he killed that patient that time, you know, and
oh yeah,
he's not great, and he is a weasel, exactly what Benton says, and again, it's just another like little sweet moment between Carter and Benton, which shuts down as soon as Carter gets a bit personal and asks him about fatherhood, and he says it's great, and then just shuts down and walks off, which is so Benton.
You're just like, Carter, stay in your lane. Stay in your lane.
Yeah. You have gone too far. Some intruder is going off in Benton's head. Carter's had it does have a better week this week, and good on him. I love him.
Delighted for him. Yeah,
I'm delighted for him. And he is twice the surgeon ever. He's twice the man Edson will ever be as well.
100%. Definitely.
And he has a funny little moment where he's dug himself into a tiny little bit of a hole with Anna.
Oh, gosh, yes.
You know, because he treats her to lunch, which is such a lovely thing. It's a really nice gesture. And, of course, Anna, still believing that he is, understandably believing, that he is an intern with no income or none really to speak of. Oh, my God, $30. Let me give you some money. And he's just like, how do I say this? I don't need, you need your money more than I do. Because that's when Carrie comes in and she's like, oh, brilliant, you caught the thing. And he kind of gets swept up in that moment. So, and then Anna puts the money on the table and walks out. And it's just like, oh, Carter, I don't think this... When she does find out the truth, I think she's going to be a little bit like, okay, what game are you playing here, John? And he's not playing a game. He's just after... He's kind of gone too far into the...
Yes.
To kind of go, oh, well, actually. So, But it is, it's still funny-ish at the moment. And actually, funny, if you don't mind, I'd love to talk about Anna for a second, because at the beginning of her, so she is involved in quite a sad storyline this week. But there's also a kind of an ongoing sad slash understanding slash butting heads between her and Doug. Yes. And we've seen this already. We've also seen them kind of explode and then come back down and then explode and then come back down, and there's another one of those again this week. So she and her med students, they meet this 20 year old athlete who, you know, he's a runner, that's what he does, and he is, you know, he's getting more and more getting shortness of breath.
He's very healthy and fit, isn't he? That's the big thing about him. He's like athletic.
So he kind of, it doesn't make sense that he's getting shortness of breath. So they do an exam, and you can see there is, you know, her her med student is like, oh, hey, man, you know, talk to me about your best speed. That's really, really good. And she's kind of like, okay, come on now. We're supposed to be listening. But you can see it's kind of written all over her face. She's like, something, you know, something is definitely not right here.
Absolutely.
And yeah, they go off to, they straight away, radiology, let's get an exam. And then I believe Doug, when he comes around the corner, he sees them. They're there at the light box. They're looking at the X-ray. She can see that, okay, that this is a symptom, oddly, of testicular cancer because it's in the lungs. So even her med student's like, but it's his lungs. She's like, yes, that can be a thing. And Doug, I believe he was... Now, there is both... This is going to sound like such a brutal word to use. There is... a misogyny in what I believe was his nice offer, but it was coming from, oh, I am man, I will talk to man about balls.
Yeah. Like,
okay, like, I get where you were coming from, Doug, but so, and she does not react well. Understandably, she does not react well to this. She's like, I can do my job, thanks very much. You know, you don't need to. And he does
I mean, I wonder, though, if he had said it in a different way, because I get what he's saying, because as a woman, say I was in a hospital and there was something wrong with a part of mine, that it might come better from somebody who's also a woman, just because they have the same experience. So if a woman is saying to me, it doesn't matter if you lose your breasts, it'll be different than if a man's going, it doesn't matter, possibly. So I feel like Doug maybe could have handled it better. I mean, instead of being like, I'll talk to him, maybe he could have been like, you know what, Anna, if you have at any moment, if you need it, you know, I'm here, because sometimes it might be easier for him to hear from a man, but not because he was a bit charging, take control. And instead, if he'd been a bit of a, oh gosh, you know, that's really tough, I'm here if you need it, she might have accepted that a bit better than guns a-blazing, Doug.
I think so. I think, yeah, like Doug, we've seen it on so many occasions. He just tends to, what is it? Fools rush in. That's, and there is a bit of that from him. All right. And so that even, I suppose, he's shot himself in the foot by even what might be meant as nice gestures have just got lost up in the soup of it now. And, you know, so she does go in and she does speak to her patient, and, you know, it's not played for comedy that he gets an erection.
Yeah.
When she's examining his testicles, you know, he tries to make a, as I probably would do the same myself in the situation, probably, you know, tries to make a joke. Thank goodness I wore clean drawers today. Yeah. And, you know, and he's like, why do you need to examine my testicles for shortness of breath?
Can't breathe. Yeah, it makes like no sense. And he's young as well, so you have to really remember that. So he's obviously really apologetic. She's very much like, it really doesn't matter. This is normal. This is what happens. He's still being very apologetic. I felt like she didn't give him enough time, like give him a moment. She kept coming back and going, no, it's all right. It's fine. It's fine. It's like, he doesn't feel it yet. Give him a moment or two to just collect himself and know that it's okay. But she just kept pushing herself on it. It's important that this gets done. I don't know. I felt like 2 minutes later wouldn't change anything.
It really would. I mean, you're absolutely right. It really wouldn't. And I mean, she's able to tell from that 2 second examination. Yes, you have a mass on your, I can't remember if she said left or right testicle, but you have a mass on your testicle. So, you know, yeah, just give him a second. And I wonder, is this her own discomfort as well? Oh my God, let's just get this examination done as quickly as possible. And it's kind of everyone is stumbling through this situation.
Because the med student is kind of in the corner, kind of like standing very, very far back, really not wanting to be part of any of this.
Absolutely. He's just like, yeah, your problem, well, not mine.
I don't need to learn that one. And the poor guy, you know, he's a student, so he's by himself. He's, you know, he's young, he's athletic, he already doesn't feel well. He's kind of come in there by himself and he's being told, well, they're touching, you know, his privates when he'd come in for a breathing issue. And then he leaves, he runs off, doesn't he? And she can't find him anywhere. And that's when she kind of concedes and goes up to Doug and says, look, you know, he ran off. When he gets back, because I'm sure he'll come back, I think it'd be really great if you could talk to him. Because I think also when she's examining him and she's talking to him about the fact that it's what it is and he starts going, am I going to lose one? I think that's at a moment where maybe having a man in the room to go, yes, but it's no big deal kind of thing, is what Doug was trying to get at, I guess.
I think so. And I think as well, when he does come back and she does talk to him, she's like, you know, would you like to speak to a male colleague? And he kind of goes like, why do you not want to look after me anymore? And I think that's probably good for her to hear there as well. She's like, okay, great. You know, like he freaked out because he's found out, oh no, I have something, an issue, whether we don't know a cancer, but it's cancer, but we don't know it's cancer, but it's cancer. You know, and it's like within a minute of the examination, I'm hearing things like 70% survival rate. Now, those are very good numbers, but at the same time, I came in because I'm having issues breathing and now I'm hearing the words survival rate. You know, I am freaking out. But he calms down enough to come back to the doctor who was looking after him. And at that point, it's okay. I mean,
it's a really sweet moment because they're talking and then Doug kind of comes. And this is what Doug should have done initially. It's that thing of hovering to make sure somebody's okay. So you're not on top of them completely, but you're there. Yeah. So he kind of looks over at Anna like, do you need me? Just via their kind of eye contact. And she's like, got it handled. And it's a real breakthrough for them, I think, because it's a bit, it shows how he could be useful to her and she doesn't always have to be defensive. And hopefully for him, he can see maybe he needs to sometimes not be all guns a-blazing and maybe show her a bit more of a gentle way and not so overpowering, like you, because it can come across as misogynist and you are a woman, you don't know what you're doing, move out way. And I'm sure Anna's had to face a lot of that while she was studying. I think it's a really sweet moment with them two at the end. And I feel like hopefully this is the start of a better relationship, less headbutty, a bit more understanding, more teamwork.
Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed.
I will say this storyline, they didn't, other shows, maybe lesser shows, might have taken this opportunity to go, well, maybe you should check your testicles more often and do that kind of leaning in. But obviously,
watch your 20 so it can happen to people at 20 as well.
But I'm young and fit.
And then you have to, you know, the rainbow goes over. It's a very special episode of VR.
The more you know.
Yeah,
like G.I. Joe. But obviously, gents, check them.
I mean,
everyone just have an old feel around. Make sure you're okay.
So I should have said, gents, people with testicles, check them.
And people with breasts, check those.
Yes.
And people with both, check them.
Yes.
Yeah, so that is a really, really cute little story.
It is, yes.
Let's go to Bent, because Benton is...
Yay!
Oh, he's just adorable.
This weekend. This week, he's just like, give me a spoon and I am ready to eat him all up.
Absolutely. Because the cold open is Benton this week, and the cuteness. So Reese is doing what newborns do, and he's having a bit of a cry. And of course, Benton is studying, and I snorted because he's like, oh, if you cry, you're going to wake up mommy. Knock, knock, knock on the door. If don't you cry. Yeah.
Bang. Oh, so if you cry, open the door into her ear. If you cry.
Yeah.
Sure,
in a deep coma, because she deserves to be in deep coma.
Yeah. Absolutely, bloody lootly, yeah.
Not, that sounds like really she deserves to be in coma. I'm saying she deserves to be having a very deep, restful sleep.
No, Ed, you stick to your first answer there,
We see you, Ed, we see you.
You always sing, that's the problem.
It's quite wonderful. In fact, I do. I meant to say, I like what you've done with the bedroom. So he brings Reese over and he's like, but do you want to study with Daddy? Do you want to study with Daddy? Yeah. And he's like, He reads his medical notes to him as if he's reading, you know, Alice in Wonderland or something. Yeah. And it's just cuteness. And it works, as I assume Benton reading any medical notes to you would work. And he goes straight off to sleep.
It works on himself later on. Sends him to sleep.
That's true,
absolutely. It's really sweet because there's this cute bonding moment between them, but we also get to see what a sweet dad he is and how he's trying to obviously improvise with everything he's got. And why I love this storyline is it's showing a working dad, a dad who works, struggling, and being as concerned about health, the care of the childcare as a woman is, you know? So, and that comes up a little bit later. It really comes out, but you know, it's sweet because then we see, you know, we've got that moment with when Mark comes by and pisses on his parade completely when he's trying to have caffeine. And then we see him. So he's back. He's in surgery with Anspar and Cordae, and he's, you know, working away. And Anspar's doing his usual, I'm going to ask questions, and asks about a W pouch. And Benton unfortunately fails to answer and talks about the V pouch instead. Cordae answers and is able to, and this is where Anspar like throws him out, says, you're behind on everything, I think you need to leave because you're not prepared for this, you need to, which I just thought was just so mean, like what a way to treat him.
Because of how Anspar follows up with this later on, it was mean. Like, it's one thing being like, look Peter, get out and get your paperwork done, but then later on, after we have quite a funny, like, what was this? Peter is so delirious from lack of sleep that he's sitting there trying to do his notes and he's trying to make friends with another doctor?
Yeah.
He has a sing song. And
no, he's like, he does that James Brown sort of, I don't know what you call it. It's just like, oh,
cat screech.
I've never fancied him more than when he's like being and just messing around the microphones. He's got a microphone like a kid with a hairbrush from the mirror being.
That's what it is. It's so childlike and human, and we don't see that from him. And it's like when we get those moments, it's like, oh, human. But this other doctor comes in and he starts talking to the other doctor, who is very not interested. And he says to him, you know, oh, do you have kids? And starts asking him. And the guy says, yeah, but my wife deals with all that, which, you know, really shuts down a conversation with Benton. But also shows that, you know, what Benton is going through is something not all doctors and not all men go through. And the childcare is as much important to him as it is to Carla. And this is again highlighted, as you say, when he speaks to Anspar later. Anspar says to him, you know, look, when Reese was first in the hospital, we were all, you know, helping you out, but now he's home. Like, that's it. That Benton's job is done now. You know, he's home. So therefore he is woman's concern. You should be giving 100% here. And I thought that really showed that kind of why it must be really tough as a woman to have a child and be a surgeon.
Yes.
There's Benton doesn't really have anything to say back to Anspar because, I mean, you could argue, of course, but then Anspar would just be like, it's your personal life, get it sorted.
Yeah, absolutely. You know?
Yeah.
We don't want to hear it. That's your thing for yourself. You need to do everything here.
There was the implication that we've all been covering your ass because you decided to have a baby. And it's just like, Anspar, like, obviously he's used to having a nanny. I don't know if he's been rich for a long time, but the implication that he's certainly not short of a few bob right now.
Definitely not, yeah.
Maybe not in a Vucelich kind of way, but still, you know.
I think he does. I think he has quite a good amount of, like, later on when we see his house and his, you know, like, I feel like he's, I think he's just as well of that generation that is very much, you take care of baby, I'm man, do work.
Yeah.
And so he's never, to him, he doesn't get why Benton has this. It's like, does not compute. Mm. Corday wakes him Benton up because Benton's fallen asleep doing his notes.
Well, she brings him a cup of tea because she's so English.
That's all we do.
Have a cup of tea. I brought some scones.
Yes, exactly.
Here's the queen who I have on the other end of this line.
It's like that nanny from last season. I've already forgotten the character's name. She's one of my favourites. Oh,
it's gone out of my head now as well.
It's catching.
Sherry Stringfield's character.
Yes.
Oh, Susan.
Susan. Jeepers creepers. Yes.
Yeah, so sorry, Susan, I thought you were asking what the nanny's name was.
No,
I
don't know the nanny's name. Susan finds that nanny who's super English, and it's almost like that kind of, you know.
It's like they think Mary Poppins is a documentary.
Mary Poppins, I can't think of. What's the name? Mary Potter. Who's Mary Potter?
Some sort of amalgamation of
a wizard boy nanny.
So basically, right, what you need to do now, Ed, is step out of this surgery and go and start reviewing your notes. We'll get you a dictation machine.
We all covered for you. We all covered for you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Give you up. Yeah.
So yeah, it's really weird, isn't it? The way I don't know, the way that Americans write and paint English people is always a laugh. I don't know if maybe we do the same when we write Americans, I can't say, but it's just this idea that, you know, we do all walk around going, oh, let's have tea, spit spot, you know.
Spit spot was the word.
You know, very like that.
Meanwhile, I'm over just, you know, chomping down on a spud.
Exactly. You
know? Drinking Guinness at the same time.
Absolutely, yeah, through the spud. In fact, we use it as a sieve. Yeah. while I wear my paddy cap. Exactly. Fiddly dee potatoes.
I mean, that's all I hear when you speak, but there you go.
Just being fair. So it's all flat caps, whippets, pigeons. And if times are tough, we cook and eat the whippet and the pigeons.
Oh, I thought you said you'd just been to the north of Ireland. I was like, not quite my image of the north of Ireland, but okay. That's
the north of England.
That's okay. That makes far more sense. I'm with you now. With you now. Yes.
Corday's being really lovely to Benton. You know, she's so charming. Wanting him to have the experiences. You know, she's very much like, oh, by the way, you know, I don't know if you know Rocket Romano, but he's going to be doing this really cool robotics thing, and I'd like you to be involved. I can get you on the team. You know, it's a really good opportunity, and Benton's very just says no, and I don't know if that's because he doesn't like the idea of somebody kind of helping him, or if he really is just like, I've got too much else going on. But he kind of says no to her, doesn't he?
I think knowing Benton, it's probably a healthy mixture of both.
Yeah, it's true.
And it's funny. Well, it's not. Well, it's funny is that Anspar, in a way, it seems like he's trying to play Corday and Benton off against each other.
Although Corday is
just like, what are you talking about? Like, we're all in this together. She helped him last week. She covered a surgery for him.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, well, you know, Dr. Corday has already raised the bar around here. Yeah, she has, but she's not lording it over anyone.
No,
you know?
And that's what I like about her, because he is really trying to play them off. You know, oh, you don't know what a W pouch is. Well, Corday, you know, and he's very clear. And I think what's great is because they're not allowing that to happen, they're taking that power from him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, later we get to really see Romano and learn a bit more about him. You know, Corday is talking to him about, you know, the patient that they've got in front of them, and then Benton comes out and she's, oh, I was dying for you to, you know, meet. So that he introduces him, and Romano, who is just so that kind of guy, the first thing he wants to talk about is Chris Rock, who is black and a black comedian who's obviously, he'd done, especially in the 90s, a lot of his kind of comedy routines were very much set around kind of the differences between black and white people, and he obviously would use the N-word. And it's a certain type of white person you get who wants to know why they can't use the N-word.
Yes.
That person's using it. Why can't I? Why are you so interested in using the N-word? You are telling us a lot here, Romano. You know, I just really hate that reduction he does straight off, because we've all been there, like, oh, I can only talk to you about this tiny thing. I'm going to talk to you about Chris Rock because he's black and you're black. Even though you've got nothing to do with each other. There is no reason for me to be bringing him up. I'm just going to talk to you about that.
It's like saying, oh, do you like Alan Carr? But you like Alan Carr, don't you?
Exactly. Well, how can you not like Graham Norton? But it's Graham Norton. Do you know who Graham Norton? You've got to know who Graham Norton. You know, it's a bit like, all right, there's more to us.
I've got a gay friend, I bet you love him. Why?
Oh, I get that as an Indian. Oh, I've got a Asian friend like you. He's like you. I get she's like you because she's Indian and nice. Okay, but there's more to me than that. Like, I've had that a lot.
You're nice. No, you are.
Sean,
children, stop this now. Every one of us is unique. Okay, now
Sharon
see.
Is the sweetest person ever, as you know that I've...
And now you're having a dig at her diabetes. For God's sake, Ed.
Honestly.
Oh my goodness. Yeah.
See why I have to deal with listeners. This doesn't stop here.
It really doesn't, yeah.
No, it doesn't.
And then a friend who's just like you, walking around wearing glasses, you know.
Bet you'd like him.
You already know him.
Yeah, probably would. You talk about being short-sighted.
Do you know him? Do you see each other?
We do see each other.
Well, they probably don't see each other very well at all.
Taking this on the road.
Secret gay men who wear specs meetings with Alan Carr. And
do you know who Alan Carr is?
Oh,
I can't think of any of the gays that wear glasses. Elton John.
That is true. Ben Whishaw, does he wear glasses?
You're not having him, it's mine.
You lay claim to a lot of men.
Yeah. Ben Whishaw's mine, though.
He is the cutest thing in the world. I'm doing a rewatch of the Daniel Craig Bond films at the moment, and I just watched Skyfall, and it was his first film.
Sky-ho.
Sky-ho?
Sky-ho.
Oh, right. Sky-ho is like a mix of Adele and the... I was going to say the Powerpuff Girls. That's not right.
Powderpuff.
Charlie's
Angels?
Completely. It's gone out of my head now. Jai-ho is the song. Anyway.
Oh, yes.
Pussycat Dolls, Powerpuff Girls. Same thing. Oh, my goodness. We better move swiftly on. Were we talking? Did we have a point? What were we talking about? Romano's a racist.
Yeah, Romano basically reduces Benton down, and then Benton leaves, and Romano says to Lizzie, "You're right. I love him. I like him.
Yeah, you were right." Well, Benton doesn't. This is what Romano does. He provokes people, and you're exactly right. Right, he's that sort of person that I've got to talk to this black person about this black thing or this gay person, But he was doing it to provoke him to see if he's gonna. Be easily wound up by Romano, which is still a real
it is
D-word move. I hate that kind of behaviour. But it's alongside the, oh, if somebody really mercilessly takes the mick out of you, that means they like you. What?
Yeah, or just playing devil's advocate. Nobody needs you to do that. Nobody needs you to do that when it comes to human.
Nobody asks you. Yeah, anyway.
Let's look at the other side of this. I tell you what, let's not.
And then
he just says, "Oh, I find Chris Rock hilarious," and that, like, Benton doesn't bite. He's probably too tired to.
That's true. Yeah.
He's probably used to it. He's probably just so used to that happening that you just go, "Well, actually, I think he's hilarious," and you just walk off and go home. So Carol, this episode is quite an interesting episode. I mean, it starts out with her and Doug making a sex tape. Is that what's happening?
I know. I was like. This is pretty fair play. Without saying it, they're basically making a sex tape.
Yeah, he's just I've rented all the equipment just as you've asked. What?
I love as well, 1997, I've rented the equipment, and yet all of us here in 2021 sitting here with cameras on our phones and everything.
Exactly. Like,
he's got like a whole transformer, he's got a sound crew, he's got everybody.
That guy in the back holding the boom, Mike,
checking levels,
Joel Schumacher has paused filming on Batman and Robin to come over to the set for this. Yeah.
to direct.
I must say, Carol had red wine in bed, and that just feels like it's going to get spilled and stain the sheets. That's all I'm going to say.
That is true. Yeah. It's like,
yeah, I mean, it is waiting to happen, isn't it?
Right? Yeah. Chekhov's gun.
Exactly. Exactly. And then, well, the whole time he's setting up the equipment, she's talking about this clinic idea she's got that's going to help women and girls, and it, and you know, really take some pressure off the ER, which I think sounds amazing.
She presents,
this is what's been coming as well the past few weeks, where she's been saying about people need, you know, them needing people.
Then you follow up care basically, and I understand, like, everyone, you understand so many different points. To play devil's advocate for a second, but Carrie makes a very good point of like, listen, I'm walking into a budget meeting here. Don't come at me with other costs. Yeah. And Carrie being Carrie, and again, I feel like these moments should get highlighted more, but she comes back down and says, I didn't mean to be short with you. Just like,
yeah.
Yeah.
This element of Carrie constantly gets forgotten. She's not deliberately rude. She might be a bit cutthroat sometimes, but she's never deliberately, or at least hasn't been so far, deliberately rude. And so she comes back down, and also, and she's entirely right when she says, okay, well, here you go. Here are, you know, how to apply for a grant and everything. This is a great idea.
Yeah.
Come back to me when you have an idea.
And Carol's gathers the stuff for her, which I think is, you know, goes above and beyond. She doesn't just say, go find funding, right? She goes, here you go. Here's this some ideas.
Exactly. And Carol's a bit like, and I just think it was Carol. She had a great star of an idea. Which, oh, yeah, we'll do this. And like, great. Oh, I don't have time for this. And Carrie's like, oh, come on now. Like, I mean, it's a great idea, but who was going to do it for you?
Yeah, you know? Exactly. I'm just like,
nope, fair enough. And then she's reading through all of these, you know, these manuals and everything, which I suppose, yes, if you're going to apply for grants, you're going to have to, you know, make sure you dot all the I's and cross all the T's and everything. So she kind of, you know, she's working through it. And she takes a break at one point. She's sitting there and Moneybags McCarter is sitting beside her.
I just love how casually he says it.
Yeah.
Oh, you should look into private foundations. You know, a lot of people out there are very rich who give away money as a foundation to kind of for tax purposes, so they don't have to pay tax, basically. And my grandma has one. Like, Carol's double take was probably one of the biggest. and he's like, what? She's like, he's like, you know, just write something down. And she's like, well, do you think she would look at it? He says, yeah, if you write it down and give it to her, she will definitely have a look. And, you know, there are other people like her out there, which is a whole new avenue for Carol to think about, but also may connect Carolyn Carter down at some, you know, some future point.
Exactly. And also, it is the first, I think, the first little paving slab for the introduction of a character who I love.
Yeah.
And an actress who I love.
Yeah.
When, you know, when she does join the show, but that will come later.
Spoilers.
Yes.
It's really cute, and I think what then obviously underlines the point is the patient Pablo who keeps coming in asking for Hale. It's Thursday, so Hale should be here. Yes, she should, but she's actually off sick. Come back tomorrow. You know, even Chuni says mañana, come back, but he's still waiting and keeps coming up and asking, and in the end Carol just takes him and hoses him down and does, so she washes him out, and then he says, can you listen to my chest, because Hale does that to check about my pneumonia. And these are the exact people that Carol is hoping to take off the ER. You know, she says to me, would you come, it's free, and he says, will Hale be there? You know, obviously, yeah, we hope so.
I'm sure she will. Meanwhile, Hale, she's like, whoa, who has just volunteered my time?
Extra unpaid shift.
I don't think so. And then that, you know, and that really underlines it, because she looks after Pablo, gets him all washed and cleaned up, and he's the exact person that they would help. And it's sweet as well, you know, that these are the people we don't always see that they are also help out, you know. And I felt like this a bit in the light when I worked in a library for a year and a bit. There were obviously library users, but then there was this whole other community of other people that would need it for lots of other reasons that people don't always see or accept. Yeah. And the care you have to do as a librarian, it isn't just about books, it's about so much more than that. And that's what those moments always remind me of, my time when I worked at a library. So so we've got this idea that Carol's going to start off a clinic, which, you know, let's see how that goes, which sounds interesting.
Indeed.
I did think it was cute that Pablo said that, oh, Hale listens to my lungs and that stops my pneumonia coming back, as if
that's it, connected.
Yeah.
Which it's you know, it takes a second to listen to his lungs. And, you know, yeah, there's no pneumonia. And it's just that, like you say, that level of extra care that, having worked in a different kind of customer service where it's about, at the end of the day, it's about money and the time is money. We don't get to sit down with people and say, okay, this is how you fill a form in. This is what you do. You know, this is how you apply for benefits, things like that. It's, yeah.
Yeah. And that's the kind of, that's what I, yeah, those kinds of people then come to the library and we kind of sit with them and do all that stuff. I think as well, what it really highlights is if she had heard even the startings of pneumonia, it would be the starting. So again, less time in hospital, less time, you know, taking up, you know, any space or whatever, less pressure, it's resources.
Preventative as well as aftercare, yeah.
Absolutely that. So I mean, it sounds like a great idea. And Weaver's obviously definitely behind it because she wants her to find the money, which again also shows, you know, Weaver's a good person too, you know.
Yes, yeah.
She's not against help, but she actually really wants to help people. That's why she works the way she does. She just understands, unfortunately, the business side of it, which is harsh.
It is.
That's kind of it for this episode, I think. Yes. So, a couple happened. Do we have any... where do we go to next?
Do you want to do Iber first?
Cool. Yeah. Now, who would like to go first?
Go on.
Sorry, I keep jumping in.
I was just going to do Rocket Romano, who is, you know, Paul McCrane is here. The rocket has landed and he is ready to shape this. You know, he's going to cause some real trouble. He's a real firecracker and as such an iconic performance and character, you know. It's love him, hate him. He stirs debate, doesn't he? And... you know, if you are a Paul McCrane fan, you may know him from, I mean, he was in Fame. He was the curly-haired kid in Fame, which...
quite hilarious to me. It shouldn't be as hilarious as it is, but just I've only ever known Paul McCrane as, you know, his head is on show for all to see.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely. Yeah, not all these kinds of cults. And actually, it's really interesting because I read an interview with Paul McCrane when this part got offered to him and he was very scared and against it and thinking he'd be this horrible villain and he didn't know how he would be able to manage it. And his wife just went, you've got to do this. This is awesome. And I'm kind of glad he did because I think sometimes it takes a really nice person to play such a punk, you know, such a horrible guy. He's been in... he's been in lots of other things. He was in 24, The X-Files, Shawshank Redemption. He's a big director now. He's into directing a lot of TV. So, and he even directs a lot of ER episodes that then will come up. That's Paul McCrane, Rocket Romano. He is here.
His X-Files episode was an episode named after his character. So he wasn't just, you know, third cop from the left. He was, I might watch that episode because it is Halloween, so I need to watch something scary every day.
Next.
Then I think Ed, you and I probably have the same one, which is Michael Horton.
From the same thing.
Exactly. And it was only that it was as soon as you pointed it out, I went, oh, of course it's him. But I didn't immediately recognize him. Although there would have been, this episode would have been the year after, because he was in First Contact and Insurrection.
Yes.
So this would have been the year after First Contact, and I think just over a year before Insurrection. So for the Trekkies out there, he is Lieutenant Daniels, who was apparently to be found fighting the Borg hand to hand on the Enterprise E, and then also asking Riker, "Was it really that smart to be flying the Enterprise with a joystick?" Insurrection.
Oh, God, the Riker maneuver. Such a cheesy bit of the film.
It is a bit. Yeah. Besides, everybody knows the real Riker maneuver is how he sits down. But yes, you're absolutely right. Yeah.
And where's my Cabot Covers? Because he is also Grady from Murder, She Wrote. He appeared many episodes as the hapless, lovelorn Grady, nephew to Jessica Fletcher.
I did see him, that credit on his IMDb.
He's hilarious. Just, you know, crazy, not crazy in that he's just very, he's a bit of a lovable loser in that he's always getting,
how many of his girlfriends end up getting murdered though,
and how many people does he end up, he always ends up with a different girl every episode as well. Like, he's always like, here's the love of my life, and then the next episode she's gone, and I'm gonna marry this girl, and then she's gone. But
oh dear. Yeah. Like, what? And was he ever investigated?
Probably not.
She.
No.
She was Teflon.
Oh right, okay.
So yeah, that's him.
Also, apparently, was the voice of John Jameson, who I presume is J. John Jameson's son, in the Spider-Man cartoon from the 90s.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
J. Jonah Jameson's son is an astronaut.
Yeah, and definitely plays a becomes something at some point. Yeah. becomes something at some point. There we are.
We all become something at some point.
Yeah.
So
the final one?
Kobe Bell, who played the poor chap with testicular cancer. I recognised him straight away, but I couldn't quite pin it down. But he was in the Gifted, which was like a CW take on the X-Men, and it had its moments, but it was a bit, yeah.
I think I heard that worth watching wouldn't be, you know, it's not going to be the one that'll change your life.
It's lightweight and frothy and fun, and some very handsome people in it. Some good actors in it, actually. But he's also in Walker, which is the new series of Jared Padalecki. He does a lot of voices too. So he was Conway Stern in Archer, and a few other voices here and there. But yeah, he's a very striking gentleman. Yeah. Definitely. He's in Third Watch as well. Brett Nicholson, that's me. He's also in Buffy as Young Man. In the episode,
yeah, I spotted
Reptile Boy.
I was going to say, is it the one where the guy, the swim team start turning into reptiles?
That is that's Go Fish, same season.
Okay.
So, bit of a Buffy expert here, I must say.
Yeah, I love it.
Particularly season two. Yes. However, the episode
I imagine, because there's a lot of naked.
It was quite a pleasant one. That episode actually featured one Wentworth Miller. Yes. Who went on to star in Prison Break.
Prison Break.
And also starred...
Shane West!
Yes, it did!
Shane
yes,
West!
Yes, it is. Yeah, Shane West is one of the swim team.
Dr. Ray.
How did I miss that?
Barnett, yeah.
That. You just have to watch it again.
Okay, then. It's on Virgin. It's on Amazon Prime and on Disney Plus, so I've got
it is indeed.
To watch it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. So, I thought... Because we've covered drugs so many times, and you guys just need to get yourself sorted.
Just need detox,
Just detox, yeah. So they keep mentioning he's throwing PVCs, and I was kind of, I didn't really know what that meant, and I thought there were maybe blood clots, because C could be for clot, but actually, PVCs are premature ventricular contractions. So there's sort of extra heartbeats that begin in one of your hearts to a lower pumping chambers, aka ventricles, the sort of disrupt your regular heart rhythm, sometimes causing you to feel a fluttering or a skipped beat in your chest. And on their own, they're just a thing, but they'll be in conjunction with other heart issues like poor old Mr. Angevine had. Spell bad news, really. So it's just the heart is in stress, you know, in distress. And it can cause a heart attack. Most are happening frequently or benign, but it can does increase the risk of developing other more serious cardiac arrhythmias. So yeah, it's just part of the whole suite of terrible things that can go wrong with your heart.
Oh, lovely. Yeah.
And on that note.
Well, I think that sums it up perfectly. I think we will call it. Thanks for listening to our podcast about everything ER. Don't forget, you can find us on social media on Instagram at YouSetTheTonePod and at @set_pod on Twitter. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. And remember, you set the tone.